Our next speaker is a person who needs no introduction. She told me to do this.
I need no introduction. The title of my talk has nothing to do with my talk. It was given to me, I inherited it, but I'll try to do my best. And I'm going to talk a little bit about my concerns and my take, and they build very nicely on what Mary just set forth for us, which is to think about the commons in the context of intellectual property and its relationship to goals other than innovation. So I'm going to broaden the context a little bit to the international realm and to some of the distributive justice issues that that Mary raised. And so to set the stage, these are maps that are Creative Commons license maps. I've actually emailed the person at the University of Michigan who's a physics professor to tell him that I've used these maps in so many, many different presentations, and they're wonderful. So this gives you a sense of where people are globally, and so the maps are proportionate to that. The next slide shows you where the licensing revenues go to. And so you can see that there's clearly a north-south divide in intellectual property as it's currently sort of framed or as it's operationalized, to the extent that Tina Rosen of the New York Times calls it reverse foreign aid. And the 2005 statistics from the UN Development Program, on which this map is based, states that 95% of patent royalties accrue to developed countries, and the territory sizes here reflect that. And then we see here also the research and development spending, which sort of tracks the patents, the patent filings. Jeffrey Sachs, who is an economist who heads the Millennium Development Project and the Earth Institute at Columbia, notes that the top 10 innovating countries account for about 94% of all the patents taken out in the U.S. This is about 14% of the world's population, whereas the bottom 128 countries have fewer than 150 patents, and they constitute 63% of the world's population. But less than 1% of the patents filed in the United States come from those bottom 128 countries. And so when we talk about formal intellectual property systems culminating things like patents, we have to be very cognizant of the fact that they're based upon a very robust sort of infrastructure for research, development, and education. So this shows the number of students or number of kids enrolled in primary school. And the good news is that there's more and more universal primary school education across the world. There's been a real push by lots and lots of different countries to provide that. However, you can see that again, there's a real asymmetry or lopsidedness in the amount of spending per pupil when measured in purchasing power parity, PPP. And there's a distinct difference in not only in spending between regions, but also in the kinds of things that students get. So even within the United States, and this map shows that we spend a lot of money, but what are the outcomes, and do we actually provide good quality? And I think this has actually quite a bit of implications for copyright policy, which I'm trying to rethink in the light of this access to education need. That is, we could actually spend quite a bit less and produce more educational materials, quote-unquote content, textbooks, or, you know, digital types of materials based on perhaps more open source models or open educational resources types of models. So more spending doesn't necessarily translate to more quality. However, the countries that spend the least also, you know, really do suffer from a lack of access to actual books, and as well as qualified trained teachers and so on. So, and here's where I start with copyright. So I thought that the various discussions about commons and perhaps the need that Mary suggested of parsing the idea of commons even further into sort of a more finely grained or granulated type of analysis, it was very, very apropos, because I'm thinking about copyright in relationship to education. And by the way, I'm not going to have many jokes in my presentation. I've delegated that to Steve. When we think about creating educational quote-unquote content, some people don't like that term, but educational works, there are three major activities that I'm going to try to address through copyright, and those are preserving, creating, and remixing. And so with respect to preservation, one of the things that we need to really be very, very cognizant of, particularly as members of a more powerful, privileged community or groups, is the idea that traditional knowledge or traditional cultural expression of minority communities may be something that do not fit particularly comfortably within a copyright paradigm or within the critique of that paradigm as embodied in sort of the idea of the commons. And so a lot of this stuff that's out there from, let's say, indigenous communities is in the commons. And, you know, as good-thinking, progressive people, we like that, right? But actually, that could be a problem, because we want to make sure that those materials aren't being manipulated or appropriated or misappropriated in a way that violates those groups' right to self-determination. So I'm going to start with that sort of problematic, that the commons is not a panacea. The public domain is helpful in terms of generating materials, but we always have to be aware of the value of that self-determination privacy and those other things that accrue to minority groups. And I'm talking about education in the sense of what I think would be the ideal model, which is to create educational works that are multicultural, that allow dominant groups to learn about non-dominant groups and vice versa, and also for groups just to learn about themselves, right? That's been a big concern of mine. So with respect to creation of content, again, when we're thinking about multicultural education, we want to foster critical analysis. Lou talked about this in his opening remarks, and I completely concur that the existing tropes and stereotypes of groups and peoples and even animals, inanimate objects even, are imbued with, you know, racial overtones, with gender-based bias, et cetera, et cetera. And so in the creation of new content, we should foster through our copyright laws and policy the ability to analyze these things and reinvent them to perform revisionist history. And with that in mind, I'm not sure that it makes sense to posit a dichotomy between open systems on the one hand and proprietary systems on the other. I think the dangers of reinforcing bad cultural memes, so to speak, exist in either one of those models. And so the point, though, is to take those models and try to encourage the creation of good content regardless. As Mary pointed out, in the copyright regime, if we choose a proprietary regime like copyright with its bundle of exclusive rights, then there are exceptions and limitations that exist in many, many countries and that are allowed under the international frameworks, particularly for criticism. In the United States, we have that for criticism, not necessarily in other countries. In fact, there was a WTO panel decision about China decided 2 or 3 weeks ago, in which China's copyright law depended on content being approved by the censorship board, and the WTO panel said, no, that's a violation of international law. But we should be thinking about, again, these exceptions and limitations to copyright based, again, on something other than pure innovation, towards a goal of freedom of expression. When we think about critical analysis, that often means subversive content that might be threatening to those in power. So copyright has a huge, huge link to freedom of expression, free speech, and that's something that any good system, any robust copyright system should include. and the creation of culturally appropriate narratives, I think, speaks for itself. So I've talked about preservation really quickly, creation, and now I'm going to talk about remixing. And remixing, it's not just about remixing, words with music and putting it up on YouTube, the Star Wars Kid, which actually I've never seen. I try not to watch too much YouTube because I know it'll just suck me in. But so we're not just talking about multimedia, but we're also talking about translations for minority languages and, again, critical analysis. And these are all things that come under, for those of you who know copyright, you know, under the rubric of derivative works, right? And so the Berne Convention, which is the big multilateral copyright convention that's been incorporated into the TRIPS, the WTO paradigm, provides minimum exclusive rights for all of these different activities that we might want to encourage, right? And they provide, to some extent, a straitjacket on what can be done without permission of the owner. There are exceptions, and throughout my discussion, I've tried to put the exceptions in red. So there are sort of ad hoc ways in which these rights can be overcome or limited by, for example, educational exceptions, the Berne Appendix, which applies to translations. I've written about Berne Article 10, illustrations for teaching exception and fairness-based exceptions. These are all different, such as fair use, which we're really familiar with in the United States. These are all different ways to kind of work around proprietary frameworks, right? But they're not... let's see if I can go back here. Okay. The exceptions are ad hoc. That's the problem with them. They are not, it's not a comprehensive framework. They depend on national laws, so each law has its own set of exceptions. They may or may not overlap. And so they provide this very rough, sort of uneven way in which we can access, things, that are, enclosed by these proprietary rights, right? So where does that leave us? So I'm going to try to wrap this up and then connect it up to the commons. So thinking about, again, preservation, we need to be very aware of the line, which sometimes very fine, between preservation or exploitation. Some of you may be familiar with the CD on the right-hand side. I first heard this music in the Reagan National Airport, and I immediately had to buy it. It's a French group, Deep Forest, and they sampled music that had been preserved by UNESCO from the Solomon Islands. It's very, very haunting music, but there's been a huge issue with respect to benefit sharing or, you know, even attribution back to the original singers. With respect to creation, here we have... Oops, sorry. I'm not the first person who've done that. I won't be the last. With respect to creation, we have... here, our own local hero, Sherman Alexie, who has created this wonderful book for young adults. And through the traditional print publication, publisher-based, proprietary rights-based model, right? And one of the things that I guess I'd like to say, one of the things that thought hard and deep about this, is that we don't want to demonize publishers. In other words, this stuff is good. And publishers do, in fact, add something. I think the trick in the digital world and moving towards a more commons-based production model is to think about what it is that publishers actually add and see whether we can try to replicate that. The problem with this model, one of the problems, is that it provides a bottleneck for the distribution of books because books are expensive. We talked about earlier, the commons being, or the tragedy of the commons, and a couple of people, Becky Eisenberg and Michael Heller, have come up with the opposite term, the tragedy of the anti-commons. When you have too much ownership or too many proprietary rights, there can be a tragedy because there's not enough access, right? And so one of the problems with creating books in this traditional print proprietary rights model is that, ironically, people won't get enough books. And it's ironic on so many different levels because Sherman Alexie writes in this book about how he left the reservation in part because there weren't enough books on the reservation. So I think we need to critique, certainly that's a very good critique of the existing model. Nonetheless, there's some value in that model. We have to figure out what it is and how we can transfigure that. Then with respect to remixing, I don't know about all of you, but I'm old enough to have, you know, learned to read through with Dick and Jane, right? I have this slide up because I think with remixing under our current fair use doctrine, which is really the huge, huge exception, right, to our copyright proprietary rights model, it's much easier to make a fair use argument if it's based on parity, right, than if it's based on this is good for education. So, you know, ironically, the funnier or the more satirical something is, the stronger the fair use argument. And this book happens to be, Yiddish with Dick and Jane, happens to be both. So fortunately for it, if there was a fair use argument to be made, it would probably win. But why can't we make the same type, why isn't the fair use argument as strong with respect to its use for educational content, right? And why is it that our educational exceptions are so weak? So this is, you know, this is the problem of having all of these ad hoc exceptions and limitations. On the left-hand side of the screen are the rights, and they are mandatory under our public law framework, Title 17. On the top in red, you know, are the various exceptions. And for a book like Sherman Alexie's book, you can see that there may or may not be exceptions for based on fair use or distance education. There are none that I can think of based on our Section 110.1. Or libraries, because it's not in danger of being, of disappearing. So there's no archival exception. And so there's just a ton of different rights. We know this. This is the critique of our copyright regime, is that there are too many rights, too many exclusive rights, not enough exceptions. So one of the things that I wanted to bring to your attention, besides, I think you all know about Creative Commons, this is in your materials, and here's an example of but if you don't know about the fair use doctrine, which is our big exception, this comic book will teach you about it in a very, I think, humorous and wonderful way. So that's on your CD. And it's, of course, licensed through a Creative Commons license. So the authors of this cartoon or this comic book have deliberately made this book as open as possible. In other words, we don't have to rely on translation exceptions. If you want to translate the book, go ahead. They're allowing you to do that under the terms of the Creative Commons license, which is wonderful. And if we had to rely on fair use, there'd be a huge battle, right? So here's where I want to link up all of the previous observations to the theme of this meeting or this conference, which is the commons. Here's a little pie chart that shows all the different ways in which we can carve out ownership models or access models to copyrighted material, copyrighted content. And so there's, let's see if I can use this laser pointer. This laser pointer, yes. So, you know, there's copyright, there's contract, there's technology, and there's the public domain, which is all the stuff that's not protected because either the copyright term is expired or maybe it's an idea rather than expression. The things in red are the things that are, you know, that would be in the commons, that are kind of accessible, that people can use without fear of liability. So within copyright, I've talked a lot about the exceptions. Within the contract model, we have a Creative Commons model as opposed to your sort of typical licensing model. Within technological frameworks, which increasingly are being used to control content through digital rights management, for example, we've got a counter model, lots of content being created and left open and free under the Open Educational Resources model. Okay? So all of these red things add up to things that we can access. And I want to suggest that I've been thinking about some of the things that our previous speakers have said, that we don't, again, want to posit the public as against the private, as if, you know, putting everything in the public domain is going to solve all our problems. In fact, there are lots of examples of mismanagement of public resources by government agencies. I don't know about you, but I don't trust the government necessarily. And so we want to think, whether we're talking about a copyright regime or a public public law regime or private ordering, what are some of the ways in which we can use these systems, design these systems, change these institutions to enhance the kinds of goals that we're looking for? In my case, I'm really interested in enhancing or introducing or increasing access to educational materials. That, to me, is the more pertinent question. And so here's another way of looking at it, that, you know, there's a core here, this white circle of protected material under our copyright law, also known as the bundle of rights. But then there are these other layers, right? Exceptions or limitations, which we can call perhaps a bundle of users' rights, something that Jessica Littman has been trying to theorize. We've got contractual restrictions or expansions. We've got the public domain. But all of these have to be, I think, attentive to the values that we talked about, the self-determination values of indigenous communities, the free expression values that allow a subversive and or critical commentary, the need to increase the overall amount of material, good quality multicultural material for everybody, it's a very complex, I think, mix of different policies that we might want. In some cases, it might be private ordering. Other cases, we might want to rely on the public law framework. I've got a lot of different suggestions about ways in which we can tweak the international and national frameworks to increase access to education, to increase access to knowledge in the educational realm. I'm not going to go through them right now because I probably am running out of time. That's my guess. There in all these different levels and all these different ways you can kind of think about or come up with good policies. And I also wanted to very, very briefly talk about the fact that we're living in an age where rather than the Arrow's information paradox, information disclosure paradox, we're living, which for those of you who are not familiar with, posits that if information is unprotected by intellectual property, there's no way to monetize it, to commercialize it. Once it's out there, anyone can use it. It's really a reference to the non-rivalrous and non-exclusive quality of intellectual property. I would posit that we're actually at this point in global time facing a different kind of paradox. We have too much information. We've got so much information, particularly those of us here in Seattle who are living at the top of the information pyramid. And the problem is, or the inverted pyramid, the problem is that we need to find ways to promulgate and distribute good quality information. And that's really actually the big challenge of our time, particularly when we want to achieve universal primary education. I just got back from South America, and I was really, really happy to see that in some countries, those XO computers, those $100 laptops, really are being used to deliver new content, good content, multiculturally relevant content, and sort of they're kind of catalyzing a new way of teacher-student pedagogy, where there's more collaboration between the teacher and students, so a more democratizing sort of effect. And this is from very, very experienced and sophisticated teachers in a couple of the different countries, Bolivia and Uruguay, and reports that using these computers to deliver educational content has increased the self-esteem of some of the kids in the indigenous or minority communities, which I think is a wonderful, wonderful thing. But we still have a long way to go with respect to literacy. And those of us who care about development, putting intellectual property together with development, Mary talked about the development agenda, which WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, has adopted. But the development agenda can only be effectuated, realized, you know, with actual good policies on the ground. And so, for those of us who care about this, right, literacy is actually a huge public health indicator, that if the more literate, particularly the women, are in a country, the better the health statistics, the better the economic growth, and so on and so forth. So, but we have quite a ways to go with respect to that gender gap that you see at the bottom of the screen. We also have quite a ways to go in certain areas of the world. And you know, my goal here is to kind of raise awareness of the fact that IP and the commons, both of them, need to and can be harnessed in the service of information for development. And we shouldn't just look to WIPO and the WTO or U.S. Congress for this. Lots and lots of other agencies, from UNESCO to the UNDP, and NGOs, you know, people like you and me, are agitating for and actually changing the standards and the rules and the laws and the norms in this area, and it's a very exciting time, I think. So I was given the title to my talk, even though I really tried to lobby for a different title by the same singer, Melanie. I loved her song "Candles in the Rain" when I was in high school. But anyway, "Look What They've Done to My Song, Ma" is a song by Melanie, and you know she did it through the typical sort of publishing route, copyright protection route, proprietary rights route, right? And you know the song is actually a critique of the system, of the man, right? And then on the right hand side, though, I have a different kind of I think warning or admonition to keep in mind, which is these are actually the words of the song in the Deep Forest CD, right, the lullaby. And so we want to make sure that we're not only fostering good practices with respect to intellectual property protected goods, but also good practices with respect to the commons. So I'm willing to take questions if there's time. If not, I'm happy to talk with people later. Thanks. Questions? And I also wanted to say thanks to Steve, especially for the humorous touches.
Hello. I'd like to make one comment. I'm a patent attorney, but my understanding of copyright law is it's a relatively limited means of protection, so the knowledge itself is never copyrighted. Copy is not the facts, but only the manner of expression. So I think there's a lot of people in the audience who may not be aware of this. So yeah. If you have a certain scientific knowledge or facts or development, and someone publishes a scientific paper, well, the facts from that scientific paper and the data can be re-expressed over and over again because the data themselves are not, or the facts or the scientific principle that they express are not copyrightable, just that basic paper is copyrightable.
Sure. So facts and ideas and processes and systems and so on are excluded from copyright protection. And in fact, to some extent, also excluded from patent protection. There are these doctrines. It's not codified in the patent statute, but there are doctrines that exclude algorithms, for example, if they're not harnessed to some sort of, you know, demonstrably useful product, right? And, you know, that's important, but the structure of the publishing industry, and I'm going to contradict myself because I said that we shouldn't demonize them. But what's happened in the scientific publishing area is that there's been kind of an enclosure of these facts because scientific journals are so expensive. I mean, they are skyrocketing in cost, and libraries, even really wonderful research libraries like the University of Washington Library, can't afford these anymore. So you can imagine how people in developing countries really can't have access to these fundamental scientific tools, right? And so there is part of Creative Commons, a lesser known part of the Creative Commons outfit is Science Commons, and its goal is to try to bring more of the scientific journals into this open access, open format model, including law reviews, so that this information can be much more accessible to people without the resources. But that's a great point. That facts themselves and ideas are never protectable under copyright law, at least in the United States. Okay, good. I actually have one more comment. I forgot to mention this either in my talk or to include it in the disc, but there's this wonderful study by the European Patent Office, the EPO. It's available for free on the website, and it's a future studies exercise. So to address the questioner, it actually forecasts what our intellectual property system might look 25 years from now. So, and it's just a great, great book. So.